We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Robert Penfold, senior investigator at the Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute, Seattle, USA, first author of the paper, Safer and Targeted Use of Antipsychotics in Youth, an Embedded Pragmatic Randomized Trial, published in the JCPP. Rob, thanks ever so much for joining me. Can you start with an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So I'm a mental health services researcher. I primarily focus on child and adolescent mental health. I'm a member of something called the Mental Health Services Research Network in the United States, which is an affiliation of health systems across the U.S. that collaborate on research projects. And so part of the work we're going to talk about today is based in that Mental Health Research Network. Our group studies ways to improve access and quality of mental health care. My goal is to improve mental health outcomes for young people. And we do that in a variety of ways, including risk stratification, making machine learning models to predict people who are at risk of poor outcomes, designing and conducting clinical trials to test new interventions to improve outcomes.
Excellent. Thank you ever so much. I'm aware there is concern about the overprescribing of antipsychotic medications to young people. So before we go into the detail of your paper, can you set the scene for us? What is the culture around prescribing to young people? And are the concerns about overprescribing justified?
You know, in the early 2000s, when I was a dewy-eyed postdoctoral fellow, antipsychotic medications were sort of just the second generation antipsychotics in particular, which were thought to have milder side effects, were coming on the market and being prescribed. And, you know, when I talked to psychiatrists who are prescribing these medications, they really thought that they would be miracle drugs, right, based on the clinical trial evidence. Mm. And so they're, you know, starting in 2000 or so and up to 2015, rapidly prescribing. And, you know, the drug that was meant to and designed to treat psychotic disorders or later, you know, mania associated with bipolar disorder came to be prescribed for a wide variety of things other than that. And in fact, even today, antipsychotic medications are primarily used for poor behavior, at least mm-hmm. in the child and adolescent population, mm-hmm. poor behavior and depressive symptoms. And so prescribing for those milder conditions or maybe more regularly thought of not serious mental illness raises concerns about whether the risk versus the benefit for using those medications balances out. And part of the concern is that the medications are associated with rapid weight gain and serious weight gain. So with one standard deviation compared to the growth chart, which is a significant amount of weight, and also with sleepiness. And so the things that teens care a lot about, you know, their you know, body and self-image, you know, being alert and able to interact with friends and participate in sports and school, are affected by that. And then even more seriously, those same things can lead to incident diabetes. And so there really are serious side effects. And so people were thinking to themselves, wow, is the risk-benefit really balancing out here?
Has it improved since that sort of onset of when it was thought to be the miracle cure?
Good question. So it has, in fact, at least in the U.S., the U.S. data that I've looked at, the prevalence of prescribing antipsychotics to young people who do not have a psychotic disorder or bipolar with mania has leveled out. Mm-hmm. So we seem to have seen a leveling out, at least anyway, of the prescribing.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Let's turn now to your JCPP paper. This is Safer and Targeted Use of Antipsychotics in Youth, an Embedded Pragmatic Randomized Trial. Can you give us a brief overview of the paper? What did you look at and why?
Maybe I could decrypt the title a little bit, Embedded Pragmatic Randomized Trial. So as researchers who work at places like Kaiser Permanente or Health Partners or Henry Ford in the United States, it's a lot more like the Canadian or British systems, where everybody who's enrolled in that system is covered by the same medical record, has the same kind of access to care, and has a set of harmonized policies that improve access to care. And so the other component of that embeddedness is that we work with the clinicians who are actually delivering care and the people who are making insurance policy and people who are scheduling care to design programs that fit into the existing infrastructure in a way that's often not done in university-based settings. You know, in university-based settings, you often have somebody who comes up with an idea, they recruit some undergrads and some graduate students, they test the idea, it works, and then they're shocked to find out that it doesn't work when they try to do it in the real world. Right. And then we have a whole field of implementation science to fix that problem. Our group tries to start with the end user and say, okay, what are the things that would hold you back from doing this thing, and can we design something that would work? So that's the embeddedness. The pragmatic part is that we had very few exclusion criteria for who we would allow to participate in the study. It's often the case that there are very strict conditions for who can participate in order to sort of weed out the things that would interfere with the program or medication or whatever else working. So we have very few exclusion criteria. The randomized part is interesting, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about the design later, but we ran over 4 health systems that participated in this study. So that was Kaiser Permanente in the state of Washington, Kaiser Permanente in Oregon, Kaiser Permanente in Colorado, and a hospital system in Ohio called Nationwide Children's Hospital. Each of them is an integrated delivery system that both provides care and has insurance products. We randomized more than 7,000 doctors, advanced nurse practitioners, and other prescribers in those health systems before we started the study at all. And so it's a cluster randomized trial insofar as when a physician or other clinician prescribed an antipsychotic medication, that triggered enrollment of the young person in the trial as well. That's a kind of an innovative design. We thought that we would not be able to stop the initial decision to prescribe a medication, but that we might be able to shorten the amount of time that the person took the antipsychotic medication if they had better access to the first line treatments, psychotherapy, for example, or other lower risk medications. Mm-hmm. So our 2 complementary outcomes were the proportion of young people who were still taking an antipsychotic medication 6 months after their initial visit, and then the total number of days that they used medication over that first 6 months. And we thought, if we give these people access to psychotherapy, and we do some consultation with a professional child adolescent psychiatrist, we might be able to shorten the time that they took antipsychotics.
Thank you. So my understanding is the goal of the safer use of antipsychotics in youth pragmatic trial was to test a more comprehensive approach to the reduction of antipsychotic medications to young people. The approach has 4 components to it, I understand. So can you describe each of these?
So we designed clinical decision support embedded within the medical record as the sort of first entree into the study. So in the Epic electronic health record, there's something called a best practice alert. Mm-hmm. And when the clinician opened the dialog box to order an antipsychotic medication for a person in the clinical encounter, it triggered this best practice alert, which is basically a dialog box that said, are you sure you want to do this? And there were 4 options then presented in that best practice alert for the clinician. One was, do you want to phone a friend? And so we had a child and adolescent psychiatrist waiting to give them consultation on what they might want to do. He said, do you want to expedite access to psychotherapy for this young person? Mm-hmm. In other words, we had a study, a group of study psychologists ready to provide appropriate psychotherapy for the young person. We also had, do you want to refer this person to a mental health navigator? The navigators were licensed social workers who would help the family get connected with care. So I'm less familiar with the situation in the UK, but in the United States, there aren't enough mental health trained clinicians to do the work. Mm. And so it's very difficult often for moms and dads to find appropriate care in a timely way for their kids. So we have these social workers in the role of, okay, let me find you a place to get care and help the family navigate that. So the 4, just to recap then, the 4 components were decision support in the record, expert advice from a child mental health and psychiatrist, navigation to help people get connected with care, and expedited access to psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. It seems very quaint now, but you know, back when we were designing this study, we said, well, what if we make this expedited access available via video visits, which was very novel 10 years ago. And you know, of course, after the pandemic became quite routine.
Absolutely.
Kaiser Permanente delivers more than 80% of its mental health now via video visits. So those are the 4 components. And let me just say, two of those things, the expert consultation and the expedited access to psychotherapy, were designed after consulting a national group of experts on what are the barriers to first line or preferred treatments that may result in an antipsychotic being prescribed. And those were, I can't get access to a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and I can't get my patient fast enough or, you know, easy access to psychotherapy. So we were trying to make it easy to do the right thing.
I want to turn to the findings very shortly, but is there anything more you want to tell us about the methodology before we move to the mm-hmm. findings?
So we use something called a modified Zellan design, which is actually a very old study design, but mm-hmm. not often used. And I have to say, you know, in initial reviews of the paper, people were quite critical of it. And the rationale behind the Zellan design is that if you only recruit people to your study that are willing to change their behavior, you will get exactly the wrong answer in your design. And so we pre-randomized the clinicians to intervention versus control. By the way, the control group got some of the decision support, but they didn't obviously get any of the expert advice or psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And offered these things and offered them to the patients, of course, as well. But we retained all of the people who turned us down in the study. And we received approval to do that from our research ethics board or institutional review board, whichever way you want to call it, mm-hmm. to do that. Because the people who turn you down are the people who you are trying to help or change their behavior. Right. And mm-hmm. if they turn you down right from the beginning, you failed. Mm-hmm. So we retained all those people in the study. So that's a kind of an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. But interesting from an ethical perspective, too, that we retained people, especially in the control arm, for whom we had no contact at all, patients we had no contact mm-hmm. in the control arm. We retained them and used their information from standard medical records and administrative claims to measure their outcomes without their consent. But we justify that in the sense that you can't answer this question without retaining those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the sort of ethical justification. So I think that's a sort of an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. And it's a design that we've employed many times because we're trying to change people who don't necessarily want to change or consent to change.
Very interesting. Let's turn to the findings. So what key findings from the paper would you like to highlight?
Kudos to JCPP for taking the paper because it was a negative study. We did not change the total exposure to antipsychotics or the percentage of youth in either arm, but there was a promising result. So the odds ratio for being still on an antipsychotic at 6 months compared to the control group was 0.75, but it was not statistically significant. And there's a reason for that. When we designed the study, we powered it thinking that 80 or 90% of young people who were prescribed an antipsychotic would still be taking that medication at 6 months. And so mm-hmm. we designed our recruitment around that comparison, right? We mm-hmm. thought we can probably cut in half the people who are in the intervention arm, which we did, by the way. It turned out that only half of the people in the control arm with whom we had no contact were still taking their antipsychotic at 6 months, which was not expected. Mm. And so even though it went, you know, sort of in the right direction, that assumption about our power turned out to not be true. So we were slightly underpowered for that outcome. However, we did conduct what are called heterogeneity of treatment effect analyses. And so we looked at whether groups in particular, boys versus girls versus those for whom we did not have recorded sex, for people of color versus white non-Hispanic folks and other groups, whether in those subgroups of people there was an effect or not. And it turned out that for young people of color in the intervention arm, randomized to the intervention arm, and young people of color randomized to the control arm, there was a significant difference. And in fact, we reduced by about a month the amount of exposure or use of antipsychotic medications. So that was a kind of interesting result. Secondary outcome, we did in fact increase the use of appropriate psychotherapy in the intervention arm compared to the control arm. Not by a lot, but by a little, so that was a positive outcome.
Can I go into more detail about some of those findings? So you mm-hmm. talked about the fact that the intervention may be effective at reducing unnecessary antipsychotic prescribing for youth of colour. What do you make of that finding? How do you explain it?
So we need to be careful. The result is true. We randomised youth of colour in both arms and compared them via that mechanism. So we at least theoretically reduce the likelihood that these are related to other reasons associated with those young people, right? Socioeconomic status, comorbid conditions, all of these kinds of things ought to be at least theoretically balanced vis-a-vis randomization. One of my mentors famously said to me years ago, randomization fails again. So it's possible that there is residual confounding for these mm-hmm. other factors that we didn't measure that we don't know about. So that's a possibility. Another one, which is sort of less desirable, is that the youth of color in the study started off in a worse place before they got into the study, and so there was more room for movement amongst those right. young people of color. And so that's something that we're trying to investigate further.
Looking at some of the other findings, so your results show what in the paper you call light touches were mm-hmm. not effective in changing antipsychotic prescribing behaviour. And in fact, in the paper you state, this is a quote, "It appears that a decision was made by the time a clinician opened the medication order dialogue box, and it was too late to affect the course of action." Can you elaborate on that? What are its implications?
You know, in the United States, to set the context, part of the rationale for this study was the positive finding from a study that we conducted earlier about the state of Washington and similar findings that happened in the state of Massachusetts, where state Medicaid agencies, and so for listeners who aren't familiar, states provide insurance to predominantly low-income and disabled folks through a program called Medicaid. And we had Medicaid-enrolled youth in this study. This is a high-risk population of young people, especially. But those programs, and especially Washington State, introduced something called prior authorization. And so when a clinician in that scenario prescribes an antipsychotic medication, the initial prescription is allowed, but in order to continue more than 3 days, that prescribing clinician is required to have a phone conversation with a child and adolescent psychiatrist employed by the state mm-hmm. to argue the clinical rationale for why they're doing this. Mm-hmm. So they basically have to get permission before that. So it's a lot harder stop on that behavior compared to what we were trying to do. I think one of the benefits of designing these light touches for us was talking to the prescribers in the four health systems about, hey, like, what could we do that would be helpful and be working with you rather than at odds with you mm-hmm. in achieving this goal of reduced antipsychotic prescribing. Mm. And so that light touch was meant to work with them and, you know, nudge their behavior rather than, you know, slapping their wrist. But it didn't work. And so we're left wondering, well, why not? And I think when we think about the workflow in clinic and how these clinicians are working with families to help them, they've listened to the clinical scenario. They know in much more detail than the reviewing psychiatrist would the scenario, the clinical scenario, the background of the family, what they've tried before, and what we're just trying to sniff from the medical records. They know the family, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think they've done the work in their mind that doctors do, that prescribers do, and arrived at this decision. And if then when they go to make the order, and they've made a decision on what to do, then to come and say, hey, we're second-guessing you, I think that was not well-received. The other piece that's a little bit humorous, actually, is that two of our reviewing psychiatrists in these health systems were quite junior and told hilarious stories of trying to have these conversations with their very senior mm-hmm. psychiatrist colleagues. Hey, are you sure you want to do this? Like, I'm not really sure that you want to do this. And then being sort of batted away, if I can use that. So that I think was a second reason. So what should we do? I think we're left with moving upstream in this process. And I think that part of the reason that antipsychotic prescribing has leveled off in the last, you know, 6 or 8 years is that professional organizations and medical schools have realized that this is probably not the best thing to do. And so people are receiving different training and looking for ways to do things better.
Were there any other positives or other changes in prescribing behavior that did result from the intervention that you haven't already mentioned?
So the short answer is no. A medical student who's at the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine in California did an analysis of all the other medications mm-hmm. that were being used by these young people, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, stimulants for attention. And there was no change, i.e. increase, mm-hmm. in the use of those medications in the intervention group relative to the control group. There was some little glimmer there. It appeared that the girls in the intervention arm did have more use of antidepressant medications compared to girls in the control arm. So there's a little mm-hmm. bit there. I should say there's actually an interesting pattern with respect to boys and girls who were prescribed antipsychotics. Boys were overwhelmingly diagnosed with externalizing conditions, mm-hmm. oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder, and getting antidepressants. And there is this sort of lore that this is a boy problem with respect to antipsychotic medications. Interestingly, in our study, we enrolled, randomized, about 50-50 boys and girls. And so that was a bit of a surprise. But maybe even more interesting, most of the girls had internalizing disorders like depression and anxiety. Mm. And that's why they were going to be prescribed an antipsychotic medication. So that's kind of an interesting finding.
Rob, is there anything else in the paper that you would like to highlight?
Maybe not directly in the paper, but I think I want to emphasize that doing this kind of embedded research in health systems where you're working with the clinicians who are providing care and the service line leaders who are directing that care and the insurance providers, you know, like NHS and NICE guidelines and that kind of thing. When you actually work within the system to conduct the randomized trials and you enroll typical patients, i.e. you take this pragmatic approach, I think we're much more likely to generate evidence that clinicians will believe and that will actually work in the general population when we turn these programs or new medications or new services, new psychotherapy, when we turn them loose, they're more likely to work. So I'm an advocate for that kind of approach. I think that in mental health and in psychiatry, for a long time, we've been producing interventions and new kinds of approaches to psychotherapy that simply don't work. And we wonder why people don't participate more in psychotherapy. You know, at least in our health system, the modal number of visits for a person initiating psychotherapy is one. And the next most frequent is two, and then they drop out. And so you're left wondering, why don't people want to buy what it is that we're trying to give them? And I think it's because we're designing interventions that have not been developed embedded in research systems, and so people don't want them.
Mm-hmm. And when you say people, you specifically referring to young people?
Yeah, young people, and I think adults too. I think we've designed approaches to psychotherapy that are then, you know, that are usually tested in adults and then adapted for young people. Mm-hmm. And they're based on the wrong kind of evidence.
What recommendations emerge from your research?
You know, it's an associated paper that we talk about in this main outcomes paper, but there are many guidelines around the world about how to prescribe and how to prescribe for various kinds of mental health disorders. And there's been a lot of work done about why don't clinicians follow these guidelines. And I think part of the reason is that those guidelines start with a condition and then make treatment recommendations. And we kind of turned that model on its head, actually. And we said, here are the symptoms and here is the clinical scenario that you're presented with. What kinds of treatments fit what you're trying to do here? And so we have this companion paper about a symptoms focused guide to prescribing guidelines. And we say, okay, under these scenarios, here's what we think you should do. And here's the first line. And if that doesn't work, here's the second line. And if that doesn't work, well, maybe let's try an antipsychotic medication after you've tried all of those things. And so in that approach, it gives you some space to think about comorbid conditions. It gives you some space to think about the history, and is more flexible for the clinicians. And so we're sort of hoping that that approach, and we're doing some more work along those lines, we're hoping that approach has some impact on changing prescribing behavior. It's a notoriously hard thing to do once a person gets trained and gets some experience. To try and change their prescribing practice later is very, very difficult. And so we're continuing research along those lines.
Finally, Rob, what is your take-home message for our listeners?
So, you know, we got a little bit unlucky with this trial. We launched it at a time when prescribing antipsychotic medications was leveling off. So that's good news, right? We're getting better at targeting antipsychotic medications to the people who really need them. And reducing the possibility of negative side effects. And I think that the professional organizations around the world and the medical schools and increased awareness from the media have created that, you know, momentum. And it's resulted in, you know, alternative treatments, alternative medications, so that, you know, young people can thrive. So I think it's a good message overall.
Rob, thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Robert Penfold, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.